We just showed up every day for 2 or 3 hours when no one was asking us, and we pushed the ball forward a little bit. And I think that's the difference. It's not about getting rich. It's about enjoying doing hard, weird things, potentially for years and years.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. What do Nike, Stanford University, Airbnb, and National Public Radio have in common? They all require information submitted to them digitally, and they all rely on Missoula, Montana-based company Submittable to make this task as simple as possible. Founded in 2010, Submittable is a software management platform that promotes, accepts, and reviews content, applications, and other digital submissions for more than 10,000 submitters and organizations. Today on Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, we'll talk with Submittable co-founder and CEO Michael Fitzgerald about the genesis, continued growth, and future directions of this Montana company with a global reach. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Arnie.
For our listeners, what is Submittable?
Submittable is a platform for accepting and reviewing any digital content, application, or RFP, any sort of digital object that's coming into your organization. It's equally a marketplace of opportunities. So if you think of anybody who's using us, say Nike's using us for accepting images, then there's people out there who are producing images. And we index all over 10,000 of these opportunities and through AI present the opportunities to individuals who create those types of things.
And how did you get this company started?
So my background is I have an MFA from the UM here, University of Montana, and I was a novelist, and that was always the goal. And I published a novel in 2006, but to pay the bills while I was learning how to write, I always wrote code. And in 2008, I was just bored with some friends, and we said we should start a company, and we didn't know what it was going to be. We just made a list of things we didn't like. And as a novelist, sending out your work was, to me, kind of a kludgy process. And so the original product was to enable people who don't live in Midtown Manhattan to get their books in front of publishers. And that was the problem we were trying to solve. We didn't solve that. But through fits and starts, got to where we are now.
And the three starters were yourself, a filmmaker, and a musician, right?
That's right. John Brownell, Bruce Tribbenzy, and myself.
So how'd you develop the business acumen to run a company that now has, what, 56 or 60 employees?
60 employees, yeah. Getting kicked in the teeth a couple times and just learning as you go. I mean, I have a liberal arts background. I don't have a business background. So, you know, I think that enabled me to be comfortable with chaos and always be learning and always, if there was a problem, that was an opportunity. It wasn't really a problem.
Walk me through the process of a customer coming your way.
So let's say the UM has an application process, which they do. Some of the schools have more media intensive. So say the music school, if they're going to be accepting pianists or flautists or something, part of that application process might be a 3-minute video. Historically, they'd have to put that on a CD, send it in, and that would be the process. With an application like Submittable, they can accept these large digital files, effortlessly set up that application, and then also set up the workflow once it comes in. Checkbox, who needs to see it, assign it to different people. And that process, what I described, happens all over film festivals, publishers, anybody accepting content that needs to be reviewed and had action taken on it.
So you have a number of companies that are receivers of information, but what about the folks that want to send in content? What's their place in Submittable?
That's right. So our very first version, the first problem we tried to solve was exactly that. It was for me, a novelist. I wanted to be able to upload my manuscript and have it just go to the pertinent publishers. And technically, that's not a difficult problem, but the problem is you have a chicken and egg. You've got to get the publishers before you get the novelist, or you got to get the novelist before you get the publishers, or you got to get them both in unison. We ran into that in our first iteration of the product. We couldn't get both sides of the marketplace. It's the chicken and the egg problem. But we over the course of many years have gotten tens of thousands of organizations that use us for accepting, and they're now looking for content. So we've indexed that, made it very searchable. And if you, the submitter, create, you know, whether you're a photographer, a filmmaker, a writer, or potential pianist at the UM school, the application figures out who you are and what you create and presents opportunities for your work. So it helps remove a lot of the chaos from the process.
So you have millions of submissions that have taken place since 2010.
Millions of submitters, too.
Millions of submitters, 10,000 companies you're working with.
Yeah.
All business needs to have capital to start. So how did you capitalize this initially?
Through fits and starts. You know, I had no business background. I didn't understand venture capital or investing. And very early on, we ran into two entrepreneurs locally, Steve Seroff and Glenn Kreisel, who had previously started and founded a couple companies, some more successful than others. And they were very helpful in sort of, they helped us with a little bit with capital, but they also were mostly helpful with advice on how to do it with very little capital. So for about 3 years, you know, we were starving and, you know, we've probably made more money while we were standing here than we made in our first year. And that was a very stressful time.
And then 2015, you took a round of initial venture capital, didn't you? From a Montana source.
Yeah, from Next Frontier Capital, or Ventures, yeah.
And then just recently, well, I think in the summer of 2017, you took another round of money from True Ventures, $5 million. Mm-hmm. And the company was already profitable at that time. So that leads me to ask the question, why take more money if you're already profitable?
Yeah. So taking venture capital isn't the best way to get rich personally, but it is the best way to grow fast. And, you know, technology is just essentially constantly getting disrupted. For me, profitability is amazing. And, you know, that should be like paramount. But my goal is really to have a large cornerstone employer in Missoula, Montana. I have two children. I don't want them to think that they have to leave in order to find opportunities. And I think, you know, being well capitalized and also having the resources to experiment and break into other markets will help us get to 500 people, which is our ultimate goal.
That's pretty impressive, 500. And when do you think you're going to get to that point?
We think 2022.
So you didn't want to leave Missoula, Montana. It was one of the reasons why you started this company.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And now it's, you know, going through a metamorphosis over time. And I noticed in some of your literature, you talk about building an opportunities marketplace.
That's right.
So for our listeners, explain what that is.
That is, you know, if you think of all of our customers, Nike, NPR, whoever, they're creating opportunities for people, whether it's to submit a short story or to submit a film, or AT&T uses us for accepting films. Then those are all opportunities. And what we do is index those and make them searchable and put metadata around them and then make it effortless for an individual. And we can do things like you sign in with your Facebook, we figure out sort of who you are, what your platform, you know, what are some of the things you like, and we present opportunities that we think might be pertinent to you. And that's super valuable, you know, and it's in every single industry. It's in film, it's in writing, it's in art, photography. And we now have tens of thousands of opportunities. So our next sort of set of development is addressing directly to submitters.
So in order to be able to expand that, you're going to have to build a company. Do you think you can find enough talented people in Montana to grow to 500 employees?
Oh, absolutely. Our software is an IP, is intellectual property. The university is an intellectual property factory. So we have, you know, every year we get a new batch of potential employees, but also people are just getting tired of the 101. Like we get amazing resumes from out of state constantly. One of the biggest hurdles that is if we truly want to be a global company, which we absolutely are and want to be, that we have to have a workforce that sort of reflects that company. We have to build products that are empathetic to everybody in the world and not just, you know, Missoula is a fairly homogeneous place. And so that's one of the things that we're really taking on right now. We have to do this before we get too big, is that we have to present ourselves as like a diverse workforce, somebody thinking globally. And it's a challenge, and that's actually a really exciting challenge. Like, I love the idea of bringing people here.
You're working globally already. You're in over 60 countries. Do you have to translate this into other languages? And do other cultures have hurdles or obstacles that we don't normally find here in the U.S.?
Absolutely. Yeah, and we I think we're in 13 languages. Don't quote me on that, but localization is part of the product. We absolutely work in multiple, you know, every major language. And then there's hurdles. Just Europe, for example, has and I think it's May 15th, they are releasing a new set of criteria around the ability for anybody to delete data from a cloud application, which seems like a no-brainer, but technically it's kind of difficult if you have two parties attached to the object. And so things like that are constantly coming up. Like I said, I think every problem is really an opportunity.
How do clients find out about you?
We have an amazing marketer, Michelle Huey. My background was writing, so one of the things people seemed kind of surprised about was how did we get our first 1,000 customers? And it was purely because we could write. You know, that is how you communicate on the web. You know, we wrote blogs before we even had a finished product. We sort of were working around the idea publicly, like saying this is what we're building and this is what we're gonna, you know, we were way out over our skis. And that can be dangerous, but it really influenced our product and it got people talking about us. People say, how do you do this from Montana? Like, in many ways, people answer the phone if they see you're calling from Montana because they're just curious. In the beginning, we did have challenges, people trusting whether world-class software could be built in Montana, but we've sort of gotten past that stage. The big issue was discovery if you were in Montana.
Do you think that in some indirect, unintended consequences, or maybe it was intended, that some of the content contributors are going to expand their horizon about what they write about or what they work on now that they know they can reach a bigger audience?
Absolutely. I mean, we get feedback constantly of people saying, I had no idea that there were these many opportunities out there, that people are celebrating a publication that they never thought they'd in a million years get published and write to tell us that they got published through the platform. And that's an incredibly engaging and rewarding aspect of what we do, for me at least.
So a writer, a filmmaker, and a musician are going to have a company with 500 employees doing millions of dollars worth of business. How are you going to learn how to run a business like that?
I think you just show up and do it. I don't know. I mean, it's really just make something that people want and try to figure out how to get paid for it.
So there's no external mentor who's shepherding, or giving you advice about how to grow this thing the right way.
I love advice, and I've had countless advisors along the way. One of the amazing things about places like Missoula is that there aren't big employers. So anybody here, whether they know it or not, is incredibly entrepreneurial. Like, people are doing two or three jobs just to pay rent. And we realize that work ethic is here. And if we could just take that work ethic and sort of realign the aim to global ambition versus just paying rent, that's something we think about a lot. We realize at the heart, people, intelligent people who work hard are living next door.
Some of our other guests have talked about the fact that Montana entrepreneurs are incredibly giving in terms of sharing their time and networking and helping others build up their business. Do you find that also to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. I find Montana is a lot like a small town more than a state, especially in the last 5 years. I feel, maybe I just wasn't in the right circles, but in the beginning, it felt like we were building a company on an iceberg. We were just pretty much completely alone, just typing in our basement. But now there's kids out there, not kids, but just people making incredible companies, Onyx Maps, Michelle Huey, Kevin O'Reilly, it's incredibly gratifying to see that happening.
We're talking with Michael Fitzgerald, who's co-founder and CEO of Submittable in Missoula, Montana. Michael, your workforce is over 60. The company's growing. Tell me a little bit about the makeup of your current workforce and what you want to do in the future.
Yeah, I think we're unique in that, one, we're significantly weighted by liberal arts majors. Two, we're over 50% women. I think especially in the last year or two, there's been a lot of discussion around women in tech and women in venture capital. I think it's really good business to hire a diverse set of people. I like conversations where we all don't think the same. If you don't have other points of view in the room, you're just closing down the conversation. And so you're limiting your company. We want as many ideas and thoughts, and that's, you know, part of what's valuable at Submittable is that I feel people can come to me as the CEO, and I mean, you'd have to ask them directly, but you know, people come in all the time and tell me what's wrong. We don't penalize mistakes. We penalize people not trying. It wasn't intentional, but we've just always hired more than half women, including in managerial roles. And we think it's essential for conversations to kind of get out of the bubbles that they can be if everybody looks and smells the same. And so we found it, I mean, that's part of our success has been hiring people like Michelle or Asta So or Natalie Bender. And we plan on continuing this. We think it's just good business.
Looking back on the past 8 years, what would you have done differently?
I mean, I often fantasize about starting over because, you know, I think I could do everything in twice as quickly as now. And you know, a lot of this wasn't fun. I've probably aged a little prematurely, and I've actually run into health issues, which I might attribute to that. But I would start hiring quite earlier. You know, I was terrified of hiring because you're essentially, you know, you're responsible for those people and their children. And I wasn't successful, I think, in the beginning, figuring out how to hire. But once you know, our rules are basically hire people smarter than you, hire people. Our three values are kindness, thoughtfulness, and ambition. And if that comes across in the interview and they're smarter than me, you just get them in the building, get out of their way, and good things happen.
What's it like working with or trying to sell your service to a Nike or an Airbnb or one of or Stanford University even?
Yeah. Especially now our deals are getting bigger and bigger and there's a lot more involved. And when we started the company, one of the things we said was we were doing the three of us were artists, but we were also developers. And one of the things we wanted to do was never have to do an RFP again. And so it was plug and play. Like we bent over, we did everything humanly possible to not have a sales force. We just wanted people to put in their credit card and not talk to us. And that works for smaller organizations, but you know, Nike can't just put in a credit card and the universities can't just put in a credit card. So those sales processes are 6 months, often years. Condé Nast took me 4 years. And to be honest, that's not the most fun. You know, a lot of that is sort of just largeness and bureaucracy, and it's nobody's fault. It's just part of what being big is, right? And we're interfacing with them, and it's just, you know, you in your basement trying to close Amazon. It's thrilling, but it's just a process like anything else.
For our listeners, RFPs are requests for proposals.
Yes.
And everyone wants to avoid those. And are you finding now that you have traction, you can avoid those and go straight in and make presentations?
Yes. We're sort of known in the industry now, so a lot of hurdles have gone away. On the other hand, I can now hire people to do the RFPs, which professional salespeople, like, that's their dog food. They love it.
So you wrote a novel in 2006. You're going to write more novels?
Yeah. I'm working on something called Start Down, which is a memoir about this, and it's about starting a company sort of in a place you wouldn't expect, a high-tech company.
So what does the future look like? What do you see a couple of years down the road, beside 500 people in Missoula and having your own, you know, office tower? What do you see for Submittable?
I see us continuing to expand the products, move into different markets. We really have a pretty clear path to a billion, and mostly just, you know, make a really healthy, awesome workplace where everyone's making 2 to 3 times the median wage and can, you know, just have engaging, great lives and careers.
So when you say pathway to a billion, you mean $1 billion in revenue?
Yeah.
And it sounds like, given your goals and what you're talking about employees, that you have sort of a social agenda as well as a strict business agenda for the company.
Yeah, you know, I definitely want us, you know, to be global, and that to do that, we're going to, I guess you could call it social. You know, we would probably run into a limit if we just did what exists in Montana. So we want to bring other people here. We want to make this, we want to show the world what Missoula really is.
And I also meant by social when talking about doubling and tripling folks' salaries that work for you.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing more engaging than seeing an employee on a Saturday afternoon walking or sort of rewarding, you know, seeing people driving cars, having health insurance, having babies, buying houses. One of the key metrics we track is how many employees have bought first-time homes. It's six, by the way.
That's good.
Yeah.
Rather than living in their car.
Yeah. I mean, we think it's really valuable, you know, that people both work. And we don't even think, I personally don't have a work-life balance. I just think everything is all part of what I do every day. But we do think, you know, a general sense of safety and a general sense of security are valuable for mental health. And
you're described yourself as a software engineer as part of your portfolio of abilities. You didn't study that in school. You studied German and fine arts. Where'd you pick up the ability to engineer software?
I just lived in San Francisco during the 90s, and I did study math. I didn't major in it, but I just am really comfortable not knowing what I'm doing. And so if something looks interesting, I'm completely fine being the stupidest person in the room. I have no qualms failing over and over again. I think most of it is kind of funny. So I got into software in the 90s and stuck with it. You know, it just was a way to eat while I was writing novels.
How have things from the 90s changed? I know they've changed drastically to, you know, outsiders. I mean, I read about blockchain technology, and it's just, I'm in awe of the complexity of it and how many people seem to work in it and understand it. But as somebody on the inside, what does the world look like now of software engineering compared to the way it looked, 15 years ago?
It's significantly more iterative. So I'll try to not be too technical about this, but the biggest change for me is when you were building a software company in, say, 2001, you would release a CD, a physical object, and you would print 3 million CDs, and you'd put them in the mail, and you'd send them to all your customers, and then they would install them, and then they would find bugs, and then they would send them back. And it was an incredibly arduous and expensive process. When the three of us first started, it was you know, we got very lucky with time as well, because it was just when the cloud was starting to come out. And cloud infrastructure like AWS and Amazon's Azure were starting to really be practical. And we shipped every Friday. For the first 2 years, we put code out into the world every Friday with not all the trappings that you needed 15 years ago. And to me, that doesn't sound really technical, but that's a huge change. And it made it possible to do stuff in places like Montana. You couldn't previously create a company with very little capital like we have.
So you got to this point by jumping in the deep end and weren't intimidated. You didn't find a lot of trepidation in jumping into the deep end of the pond. For budding entrepreneurs, what would you share with them in terms of lessons that you've learned by taking the plunge?
I learned a lot from writing a novel. No one's paying you in the beginning. You know, the first thing you realize when you start a company or build a product or when you write a novel is no one asked you to do it. Like, that's generally, you write 400 pages and then you wake up one day and you're like, oh my gosh, I forgot. No one asked me to do this. And then you have to go sell it. You know, you've put your family under duress while you take time to do this stuff. So I would just say try to do two or three hours every day of something that no one's paying you for. You know, just, and something that you care about. Like, I was recently diagnosed with pretty advanced colon cancer. And so I suddenly, and I'm not saying that to put a downer on it, because treatment's going well and I'm an incredibly fortunate person, but I'm suddenly very, very curious about cancer. And a lot of the problems that I ran into were around information. So to me, there's just a huge opportunity in health. And I'm not saying I'm launching another company. Hour or every day I do a little bit. I'm working on an app called the Hey Pump Finder. And I don't know what it's going to be, but it's super engaging for me to just clear my head from work a little bit. Also type a little bit of code because I don't code anymore. And I feel that that's the thing that we did. We just showed up every day for 2 or 3 hours when no one was asking us, and we pushed the ball forward a little bit. And I think that's the difference. It's not some huge idea. It's not, venture capital. It's just being able to work on your own volition. And it's not about getting rich. It's about enjoying doing hard, weird things, potentially for years and years.
Michael, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I look forward to the day when you have 500 employees buying houses in Missoula and earning two or three times what the typical current earners do. And we will watch your progress with great interest.
Thank you, Ernie. It's been a pleasure being here. Thanks so much.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs. Produced by Autumn Barnes and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time to Can Do, when our guest will be Peter Kearns of 180commerce.com, a company that helps sellers access and understand the fast-paced world of online retail sales. Once again, I'm Arnie Sherman wishing you peace and prosperity. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.